You know, as Christians, we regard Jesus as unique as a teacher. He's from God in a way that no one else actually is. John 1:18, no one has seen God at any time. No one. Not even Moses or any of the other prophets. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. And John's idea is one of closeness and intimacy, being privy to the deepest thoughts. Remember, John himself lay on Jesus' chest as Jesus spoke to him and they talked. Well, Christ is in the bosom of the Father. He's leaning up against the Father and the deepest, most intimate things are being spoken. Truth, absolute truth, is being spoken, and Jesus brings that truth to us. Christ has a perfect understanding of how we ought to live, and Christ also has a perfect understanding of how we are prone to live as sinners. He knows the thinking and the motives and the motions of the sinful human heart. He knows the way you tend to think as a sinner, as well as me. And Christ has come to change our way of thinking, to completely turn it upside down. He's come to change the way of speaking and acting. In our passage this morning, he addresses our tendency to assess others for the purpose of condemning them. Let's read our text, Matthew 7, verses 1 to 5. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with what measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but don't consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your own eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Don't give what is holy to dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. Now, the passage we read this morning is often quoted to denounce any kind of assessment or criticism of another's behaviour or their teaching. And people will often say, hey, listen, Jesus taught that we shouldn't judge each other. That's not what the Lord is talking about here. There were occasions when Jesus himself openly condemned the religious leaders in Israel. For instance, he called the Pharisees whitewashed walls, tombs. On the outside, they looked lovely. On the inside, they were corrupt and full of death. He called them hypocrites who placed high demands on other people, but didn't bother to apply those same demands to themselves. He warned his disciples, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Watch out, he says, for false prophets who will come to you in sheep's clothing. How would the disciples know these false prophets? By their works, by the things they taught and practiced. This all involves assessments of other people, their words as well as their behaviour. And the same carefulness is urged by the apostles. For instance, Paul. He says in Philippians 3:2, beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the mutilation. He's referring to those who want to add things to Christ as a way of salvation, particularly the Judaizers who said that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. You see what Paul's saying? They're dangerous. Keep away from them. 2 Timothy 2, verse 15, shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness. Their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort. Here's a man who's prepared to name names and point fingers. 2 Timothy 4, verse 14 and 15, Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works. You must also beware of him, for he has greatly resisted our words. How many would look at Paul and say, oh, this man is uncharitable? No, Paul is a true and tender shepherd. He's warning Timothy about a man who may not only harm him, but greatly harm the gospel. The Apostle John is the same. He speaks about Demetrius and Diotrephes. On the one hand, Demetrius has a good testimony as one who loves and practices the truth. He's an earnest Christian. On the other hand, we have Diotrephes, who has a reputation for loving the preeminence. He loves the sound of his own voice. He wants to be central to everybody. And therefore, when other people come who can minister, no, we won't have them. It's John's intention when he visits the region to speak out against Diotrephes. So when Jesus calls us not to judge, he's not telling us to cover our eyes and our ears to the teaching of others. He's not telling us to suspend all assessment about others, about what they are saying and doing. There are many people who want Jesus' words simply to mean, just live and let live. They want the freedom to choose for themselves what they want from Christianity. They want to be able to interpret Christianity in a way that best suits their own desires and needs. And they want to do so without being challenged about it by others. Jesus said we shouldn't judge. This is the way of the world, of course, isn't it? Don't you make me feel bad about what I do or say, whether it's right or wrong. And this tendency has even been enshrined in vilification laws. There are now laws that say you cannot say anything about another person that might make them feel bad about themselves or about their situation. This is not at all what the Lord had in mind. So what is the Lord teaching us here? What's he teaching his disciples? Well, we come to our first point this morning. Jesus is teaching us, in terms of application, I should say, Jesus is teaching us that we must not become censorious. The censorious person assesses others for the purpose of finding fault. They are out to uncover and highlight the failings, the flaws, the weaknesses in others in order to condemn them. They will generally put the worst construction on words and actions. They will generally be negative about the lives of others, not generous regarding their mistakes. And you know what? Jesus knows that we are prone to this. We're not talking about someone out there. We're talking about this person. We're talking about ourselves. Why are we like this? Why do we tend to be censorious? Well, generally, friends, it's for the purpose of exalting ourselves, promoting ourselves. We disparage others purely as a means of rejoicing in ourselves. Jesus told a very well-known parable about a tax collector and a Pharisee both going up to the temple to pray. The tax collector stood afar off. He wasn't able to raise his eyes to heaven, so conscious was he of personal guilt and failing. The Pharisee, on the other hand, comes right up close and he thanks God he was not given over to other sins like this, like others were, particularly this tax collector. And Luke says that Jesus directed this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. When people are smug, when people are conceited about their accomplishments and their correctness, especially concerning the Christian life, they become very ready to criticise others. And that was the whole issue in the book of Galatians. Paul, in applying his teaching in Galatians, ends up saying, let's not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. So we may disparage others and criticise them for the purpose of rejoicing in ourselves. We love the idea that we are better than others. We do so to promote ourselves. We may also be critical of others for the purpose of protecting ourselves. Solomon wrote this, and how insightful he was, obviously being taught by the Spirit of God. He says, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbour. When men are focused on achieving something and giving their energies to it, and they advance in it and progress in it, others will resent them for it. It may be in their business acumen, the time and energy they give to their business and it flourishes. It may be in personal fitness. It may be in terms of their garden or their home. They have something lovely because they've worked hard. they will often be resented for it by others, for the simple reason that it highlights their own lack of resolve and their own lack of diligence, their own short-sightedness. And this is especially the case when people make advances in their Christian character and in Christian discipline. What's the best way to cope with being shown up? Well, you begin to search for failings and weaknesses in the lives of those people. And you do so to take the lustre off their good testimony. This is a tendency common to us all. Fuller prayed this: "Take away from me, Lord, this bad spirit, and turn my envy into a holy copying. Let me labour to excel in striving those who excel me in their particular godliness." In other words, Lord, should the godly behaviour of others show up some failing in me, rather than resent them, give me the grace and energy to strive for that same godliness. How do we respond when we hear that another person doesn't let their children watch a program that we allow our children to watch? Well, of course, we feel a bit exposed, don't we? How do we deal with it? We will often say, well, you know what? They also do this with their children. There are other reasons we become censorious of others. Often we do it to give ourselves a sense of power and authority over other people. You know, our sinful nature is characterised by arrogance. To have another person cringe when we look disapprovingly at them is actually quite personally rewarding. They fear me. They're actually adjusting their behaviour in order to make me happy. We have the same feeling when they look to us for approval. What did you think? To foster in others such a looking to us is actually obnoxious to God. For that's to take the place that only Christ should have in people's minds. Now, it's not out of place at all for Christians to look to another for guidance, and for that other to use that looking well. But that's not what we're talking about here. Paul observed a tendency in members of the churches to set themselves up as judges over others because they enjoyed having people cringe at their disapproval or look to them for approval. He called them instead to receive each other, not for the purpose of making rules for each other in matters they needed to make up their own minds about. Romans 14, verse 4. Who are you to judge another's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. It is Christ each one serves, and Christ the one they will give an account to. And you know, this is something that every Christian is prone to fall into, but especially church leaders. Oh, what a wonderful thing it is to have people looking to you for guidance. And it's very easy to develop a love for it and a thirst for it. And it's very easy to look disapprovingly and have people cringe and enjoy it. This is wicked in the eyes of God, wicked in the eyes of Christ. And everyone who leads ought to be very careful and wary of it. Christ is the one each one serves, and Christ is the one that each will give an account to. You know, it was this truth that assisted Paul to ignore the criticisms of his adversaries. And he had plenty of adversaries criticising him. He ends up saying, "For I know nothing against myself, yet I'm not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord. Therefore judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the hearts. Then each one's praise will come from God." He's basically saying to them, listen, you've decided that I've got bad motives. I know that's not the case. But ultimately Christ, who knows all things, will decide. He is the judge. Wait till then. So it's our general tendency to be censorious, to look for faults and weaknesses in others for our own sakes, to rejoice in ourselves as better than them, to protect ourselves from being shown up, or to have power, to have a hold over others. Now the Lord gives us a warning, doesn't he, in this passage. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. The very standard we apply to others, which we use to dig up and root out their failings, is exactly the standard that will be applied to us. Who will do the measuring back to us? Well, certainly men will measure it back to us. The censorious person always highlighting others' failings will find that they themselves will be exposed to the condemnation of others. And more importantly, God will measure it back to us. John Stott uses the setting of a courtroom. And he says this as he applies this passage. If we enjoy occupying the bench, in other words, sitting in judgment, we must not be surprised to find ourselves in the dock. The scriptures are very clear on this point. The judgmental person, the censorious person out to condemn others, will be wounded and killed with their own weapons. They'll be condemned by the same standard with which they judge others. Why is censoriousness so offensive to Christ? Why is it so offensive to God? It's because Christ is exactly the opposite. He finds no pleasure in discovering failings. He finds no pleasure in exposing them. When he deals with us, it is with all the slowness and tenderness that our particular sins will permit. Some sins, of course, are very serious and need to be exposed quickly. But Christ doesn't love doing it. He loves to bless us and encourage us. He will do what's necessary. He will not hold anything back that we need. But he finds no pleasure in discovering failings and no pleasure exposing them. He loves us. So then, how is a believer to relate to other believers in this whole matter of judgment? Firstly, with carefulness. We will often find it difficult to know all that's involved in a situation. John Wesley gives an account of a man he considered to be miserly. At one time, this man only contributed a small gift to a good cause. Wesley condemned him as covetous. After the incident, and by the way, openly condemned him as covetous, after the incident, the man went to see Wesley in private and explained to him that he'd been living on parsnips and water for several weeks. Before his conversion, he had gotten into some serious debt. And now, by skimping on everything and buying nothing for himself, he was paying off his creditors one by one. He said to Wesley, "Christ has made me an honest man." And so, with all these debts to pay, I can only give a few offerings above my tithe. I must settle up with my worldly neighbours and show them what the grace of God can do in a man, in the heart of a man who was once dishonest. Wesley apologised to him and asked for his forgiveness. So many times, we're unable to see all that's going on. So the Christian must exercise caution in his assessments of others. We also need to exercise compassion. Compassion takes into account all the things that contribute to another person's failings, the particular pressures they were under, whether it be financial pressures, domestic pressures, health pressures, relationship pressures. You see, there'll be many times when a person has indeed sinned and they are responsible, but as we consider all the things that contributed, we will wonder if we also might not have done exactly the same thing under the same circumstances. And so, as believers, we should be ready to take into account everything that would mitigate a person's guilt. How are we to assess others? Also, with self-awareness. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 21. Also, don't take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. You see, the knowledge of our own behaviour in the past ought to greatly reduce the sense of offence at the weakness of others. Our own weakness in the past should introduce a degree of gentleness into our dealings with others. And we should also have a sense of our weakness in the future. In Galatians 6 verse 1, Paul writes, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted." Basically he's saying this, as you deal with your brother over his offence, remember it's quite likely that one day the tables will be turned. For you carry the same weakness in yourself. It may be that one day they are dealing with you. Deal with them as you would hope they will deal with you. You see, a sense of our own weakness in the past. I'm criticising someone for what I myself have done. And our weakness in the future. I may be in exactly the same position they are, so let me deal gently with them. It must be dealt with. No doubt about it. But let me deal with them in a way that I hope they would deal with me. What the Lord is talking about is seen in two very different approaches to the same sin. The scribes and the Pharisees dragged a woman before Jesus in front of all. "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act." You see, they were publicly humiliating her, hoping to publicly humiliate Jesus, and he gave his response. So you can see their motives. You contrast them with Joseph when he found out that Mary was pregnant. At least he believed she was pregnant through immorality. Luke says that Joseph, being a just man and not wanting to make her a public example, was minded to put her away secretly. He was a man offended and hurt. He had to act. But love for Mary caused him to do what he could to minimise the impact on her. And that's what it's all about. Love changes our whole approach to the sins of others. We must act. But what's moving us to act, and how do we act? When a Christian is truly under the guidance of the Spirit of God and controlled by the Spirit of God, love blooms in their heart. We are not moved to hurt. We are moved to bless. Yes, we might have to say some hard things, but we will only say what's necessary. In giving many instructions in his letters, Peter writes, "And above all things, after all that I've said, I could give you a list of 1,000 things. At the top of my list is this. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins." He's not talking about sweeping things under the carpet. He's talking about dealing compassionately. He's talking about minimising the impact as you have to deal with the sins of others. My second major point this morning, and not nearly as long, is we're prone to hypocrisy. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? It's a very graphic illustration, isn't it? Maybe you watched one of those amazing medical escape type programs, and you've seen people come into the emergency room, perhaps with a metal bar passing through their head. They're awake. They can talk. It doesn't really seem possible. How come they're not dead? They need medical assistance to get it out. Well, Jesus' words bring to our mind a man walking about with a plank sticking out of his eye socket. And this man is glaring at another. "You've got a speck of wood in your eye. I can see it." Now, as sinners, we have a remarkable capacity to overlook in ourselves what we condemn in others. Many of the Jews looked upon the Gentiles with utter contempt because they practiced things God's law condemned. But Paul writes to them, "You are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things." You know, maybe we have maintained a certain degree of self-discipline in one particular area, perhaps in the area of eating. But we refuse to allow our appetite to rule us. We look at another person who is obese and shake our heads. They ought to be ashamed. No self-control. But we ourselves might be quite shameless gossips who don't practice any self-control over our tongue. Proverbs 26, verse 23, the words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles. So we restrain ourselves from the food available on the table, but not with the food available from the talebearer. At times, the very thing we highlight in others and condemn them for is the very thing we are also practicing just in another setting. Remember David? Nathan comes to him with a very sad story. A poor man had one little ewe lamb which was like a daughter to him. A rich neighbour had a visitor come to stay. Instead of taking a lamb from his own large flock, a lamb quite impersonal to him, he took the poor man's lamb and slew it to feast his visitor. David's response to the story, very angry. As the Lord lives, the man who has done this thing shall surely die. He's ready to execute the man. And you know Nathan's response, you are the man. David had taken Uriah's wife, very dear to him, and taken her for his own personal pleasure when he had numerous wives of his own, and then killed Uriah to make all things appear in order. And here was David, ready to act as the great righter of wrongs, the wielder of the sword of justice. But he had done the very same thing, only worse, the same sin in another setting. He made himself blind to his own terrible injustice. That is what we are all prone to do. My third point is this, in closing. We must be in a position to God. First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your own brother's eye. The Lord never intended by his words to turn us away from the duty of watching over others. Yes, we are our brother's keeper. We are our sister's keeper. The Lord does not mean at all by these words, don't worry about others. His meaning is this, worry about yourself first. Then you're in a position to worry about others. The fact is, when hypocrites try to be a guide to others, try to help them, perhaps negotiate right and wrong, great evil results. Paul cries out against the Jews of his day. He says, "For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." See, God intended them to be a light to the Gentiles, to be a guide to them, to guide them in the knowledge and the ways of God. But they did the very things they were telling others not to do, and the results were tragic. The Gentiles ended up being disgusted with the God of the Jews. What greater evil can there be than our actions making Jesus Christ ugly to others? The man or woman anxious to bless others with the truth must practice the truth themselves. Paul gave specific instructions to Timothy the minister. He says the hard-working farmer must be first to partake of the crops. As Timothy carried out his duty to preach the word, as he spent time studying scripture, preparing sermons, speaking to people privately and publicly, he must be the first one to benefit from his own labours. The first one to sense the importance of what he's reading and preparing. The first one to be shown up and cut and wounded by what he's reading and preparing. The first one affected by it. And he needs to be the first one to apply it to his life. The spiritual nourishment he was to prepare for others was intended for him first. That's why Paul says to him, "Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this you will save both yourself and those who hear you. You know, some ministers have been saved by their own sermons. Some ministers have been preserved by their own sermons. Actually, not some, probably not, probably most, if not all. Because we're all the same. When God gifts a man to minister to God's people, that gift is sometimes for his own salvation, as well as for those who hear him. But this has a direct bearing upon us all. If we love our own souls and the souls of those under our care, we will take pains not only to teach well, but to practice the very things we preach, the very things we teach. Many of you here today are fathers and mothers. Do you practice before your children the things you preach and teach? To have the talk without the walk not only ruins us, it ruins those who we seek to guide. They are offended. They do not want to know the Jesus we teach. If we are hypocritical, they are offended. You know, a genuine love for those under our care has been the catalyst for some to really take seriously their own Christian lives. I've mentioned before Enoch. It seems that after his son was born, that's when he begins to walk with God. As he looked at this little child and he thought to himself, this is a sinful and an ungodly world. I'm a sinful and ungodly man. How can I teach him and preserve him if I am not walking with God? You may have grave concerns for your children today. But are you a godly man? Are you a godly woman? In closing, do you love those around you? You not only have a duty to save yourself by hearing and applying the ways of God to yourself, you also have a duty to save and guide others by declaring to them the ways of God and by practicing the ways of God. Being a hypocrite is a great stumbling block to the growth of the church and the growth of the gospel. One of the things we need to take to heart today is that we are all sinful and flawed people, even though we have the Spirit of God residing in our hearts. What's the effect of that upon us, of realising that? Well, God doesn't ask us to suspend all judgment and assessment. What he calls us to do is to act lovingly to each other, act lovingly before each other, that we might, in a sense, show the graciousness of Christ. But remember this, brethren, if we live hypocritical lives, we will not bless others. We'll end up hurting them as well as ourselves. May the Lord deliver us from hypocrisy. Let's seek God's face in prayer.